We're going to proceed now with the conclusion of Radio Free America number 37, and what we're looking at this evening is the effects upon the United States of the development of the national security state to fight the Cold War. Now, in reality, virtually everything else that I have put on tape, that I put into the archives for the 13-plus years that I've been on the air now, bear testament to the effects of the development of the national security state on American society. So what I'm going to be doing this evening is, to a certain extent, simply touching lightly, not lightly in the sense of emotionally lightly, but moving through briskly, perhaps would be a better word, moving briskly through the effects, some of the effects, of the growth of the national security state on the United States. And basically, the effects of fighting the Cold War, the effects of the U.S. having lost the Second World War, again, not a military defeat, but a political and consequently economic defeat. The most significant effect of the U.S. having lost the Second World War is that the United States now basically has a political system that is only too reminiscent in certain major respects, not completely reminiscent, but in certain respects is only too reminiscent of the political system that prevailed in Nazi Germany. It should be recalled that fascism is not something which simply appears. It develops one stage at a time. As I have read over the years from a book called They Thought They Were Free, fascism, as it moves into place, as it develops, develops one small stage at a time, and each step does not appear to be that much worse than the other step. But we in the United States now have arrived at a point where political assassination has become an established way of life. We no longer see the major politicians, such as the Kennedys or Martin Luther King, major political figures, I should say, being assassinated, but journalists like Danny Casolaro, smaller figures, so to speak, are assassinated as a matter of routine and with impunity when they run afoul of the national security establishment. The media lie about it, including the so-called alternative media, for the most part, and as always, note the use of the term so-called. We live in a society where our government is complicit in the drug traffic, which they are eliminating our civil liberties in order to eliminate. With the war on drugs, in quotes, has resulted in some shocking limitations of American civil liberties and threatens to do even more in that regard. We live in a society where the judicial process has become enormously corrupted as a result of the development of the national security state. We live in a society where the journalistic process has become almost totally corrupt as a result of the development of the national security state. And it is the effects of that national security state on American society that we're going to be touching on this evening. We will also be taking a look at the developments in Europe that are taking place right now, not only in Germany, but Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, as a result of the end of the Cold War. It should also be noted that one of the effects of the development of our national security state is that there are significant elements of our national security establishment that are complicit in the very acts of terrorism that we are told we need to protect ourselves against. We have been told so often in the last 20 years or so that we need a more aggressive military posture abroad, reduced civil liberties at home, in order to combat international terrorism. And as we have seen in so many archive shows, Radio Free America number 4, Radio Free America shows 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, and several miscellaneous archive shows. In fact, the United States itself has been complicit in many of those acts of terrorism. We're going to be touching on that this evening, but these are merely some of the ways in which the development of our national security state has corrupted American democracy to its very marrow. One of the things that I find genuinely terrifying about the current electoral campaign is that here in California, we have the Death with Dignity Act. Euthanasia is going to become legal in California with the patient's consent. Recall that in a miscellaneous archive show about the development of the Nazi extermination programs, we took a look at how the Third Reich's extermination programs grew out of the Nauer case. That was a case in which a German couple named Naur had a horribly deformed child that had no reasonable prospects of developing to a viable adulthood, so they requested of the Fuhrer that they be allowed to put it to sleep, and the Fuhrer gave his consent, being the humanitarian that he is, or was, and that, out of that particular case, the Naur case, ultimately the Nazi extermination programs grew. It began with euthanasia and moved forward into wholesale genocide. And as we face the very real possibility of a financial collapse in this country, banking experts are forecasting the collapse of major commercial banks later on this year or early next year after the election. I think the effects of that on American society should be very carefully considered. I am afraid that an awful lot of people are going to slip through the already porous safety nets that exist or theoretically exist beneath us. And the development of the Death with Dignity Act, the development of legalized euthanasia in this country is something that I think we have to watch very, very carefully. Again, the growth of the national security state and the corruption of our political process has been the major focus of all of the archive shows available from Archives on Audio. So in reality, all of the archives themselves could be said to represent the effects of the development of the national security state on American society. But we're going to be touching on some of those this evening, and I thought by way of beginning the discussion, this last section of Radio Free America 37, it might be useful to listen to a section of the radio play High Command. I played this in the third installment of Radio Free America 37, and I thought it might be good to reprise a short section of that this evening. So we're going to listen to a short section from High Command. Recall that this was originally recorded and broadcast in 1944. So what we're going to hear now is a short section of the radio play High Command from 1944.
The scene is Berchtesgaden again. The time is in a not-too-distant future. And a few minutes after Herr Hitler has been permitted to flee to the sanctuary of one of those neutral countries which still refuses to distinguish between political refugees and global criminals. The characters, the High Command, the same old gang. Their grandfathers unified Germany and crowned Wilhelm I emperor in Versailles in 1871. Their fathers made the deal at Compiègne in 1918. And as their fathers did then, they have just fired their front man. The German High Command, which has ruled Germany for nearly a century, carries on.
Well, gentlemen, now we can get down to business. What are your feelings about peace terms?
The policy we followed in 1919 will do admirably now. Object to everything, cry poverty, and play upon world sympathy.
We are in a much better position now than we were then. The machinery, the hard pressures. Now we have the loot of all Europe.
Of course, you realize they will push us back to our old borders. We will probably even lose Austria for the time being.
That's all right. What good is France or Poland or Norway to anyone now? What are the latest figures on Poland, von Bach?
Oh, I've lost count, General. We must certainly have annihilated at least 3 million Poles and Jews, and a great percentage of the young women have been sterilized. There's not much danger of Poland breeding a generation of fighting men in the next 25 years.
How about France, von Rundstedt?
Well, you know Hitler has had 1.5 million Frenchmen in prison camps and labor battalions since 1940. They're worthless as fathers now. And in France itself, we've managed to increase the death rate over the birth rate. The children that are still alive are quite worthless. Starvation is so much more effective than machine guns, especially with the young. We agreed before this war began that our great mistake in 1918 was to spare the civilians of enemy country. We agreed that it would be necessary to destroy at least a third of the inhabitants of occupied territories. I believe I can safely say that this has been done.
There's no doubt about it.
Good, good. Now, here within the Reich, I think it will be advisable to continue with the sex freedom introduced by Herr Hitler. We must breed a sufficient number of strong young men so that in 25 years we will be in a position to resume our campaign for world domination.
We'll have to go carefully with that. We'll need the sanction of the church for the next few years.
Don't worry. There are ways. Nudism and strength through joy were very successful before. You can always describe license as freedom and modernism.
I don't think that it's too early to review the mistakes we made this time and to face the hard facts of our present position. The United States is now the greatest sea power in the world. Yet even the British Navy alone kept us from invading England. We must build a great navy this time.
You think they will let us?
They forbade us to rearm before. But we found a way then. We will find a way now. But there is one mistake we must not make again.
What is that, General?
That was the fundamental error we made this time. We should have realized from the first that the United States would be the heart of Anglo-Saxon power.
Then the United States must be defeated the next time.
Certainly. The unpleasant truth is, gentlemen, no nation can hope for world domination unless it controls the vast resources of the United States.
Agreed.
Our strategy must be directed toward America.
And doubly intensified. We must not make this.
Roger's stuff.
You can't get away with that in this day and age.
You don't have to take my word for it. Just read your own newspapers. Right-hand column, page 3, New York Times of May 26th. An Associated Press dispatch from London, dated May 31st. The 3-column story on page 5 in the New York Post of February 5th. Page 51 on Life magazine for May 8th. Our plans are not secret.
That's a lot of propaganda.
The Fuhrer said, the bigger the lie, the more likely it is to be believed. But you, Mr. and Mrs. Manfred, prove another axiom.
Huh?
What?
The bigger the unpleasant truth, the less likely it is to be believed in America.
Yeah, there are a lot of unpleasant truths not to be believed in America. And unfortunately, an awful lot of Americans have retreated from those unpleasant truths. However, here on One Step Beyond, I have been doing my best to confront those unpleasant truths, and I'm going to continue to do that. Again, I want to emphasize that in a very real sense, all of the other archive shows could be said to constitute, to represent, to delineate the effects of the growth of the national security state on American society and to document how we lost the Second World War. But I don't think there's any aspect of the corruption of American society that is more important or illustrates what we have paid as a nation in fighting and, quote, winning the Cold War. We won the Cold War, but in doing so, as I have illustrated in the broadcasts that I have been doing since July 26th, we lost World War II. And the growth of the national security state and the corruption of the legal process and the political and journalistic process as a result of that are simply part of the price that we have paid. By way of taking a look at the articles in the contemporary press, just as the radio play High Command from 1944 wound up with that German character played by Paul Lucas saying, just read your own newspapers. Well, let's take a look at our newspapers today. From the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, October 5th, 1992, there's an open forum op-ed column by Saul Landau, a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. It's headlined, U.S. Government Secrecy is America's Achilles Heel, and it reads in part as follows. The Democratic attack team, hoping to offset Bill Clinton's draft status problems, is elated over revelations that President Bush lied about his knowledge of the Iran-Contra affair. Howard Teicher, T-E-I-C-H-E-R, a former national security official, told Nightline on September 24th that in 1986, Vice President Bush was briefed on the details of the Iran-Contra shenanigans. But the issue isn't really about whether or not Bush is lying or whether Clinton was a draft dodger. The real issue transcends both the current campaign and the questions of what Bush knew and when. Scandals of our era have revealed the Achilles heel of contemporary American democracy, secrecy that is protected by a secret apparatus operating on a track parallel with, or at cross purposes to, the legitimate government. With each scandal, we discover that a national security elite, quote, classified, unquote, information to cover up shady business. Indeed, national security logic would lead us to believe that Iran-Contra documents are secret because revealing them compromises U.S. security. But who is at risk when the public learns of Bush's participation in allegedly criminal conversations with other cabinet members in 1986? From the late 1940s, national security emerged as a murky doctrine that justified the creation of powerful new agencies, agencies that presumed a permanent state of crisis. National security officers replaced openness with secrecy. Routine accountability to government workings became restricted. And bureaucrats found endless, quote, threats, unquote, to convince Congress to renew their budgets. National security ideologues released reams of documents to justify ever more expensive weapon systems. In the 1980s, as the Soviet Union atrophied, they assured the president that the enemy was more powerful than ever. So we got new bombers, nuclear subs, land-based missiles, and Star Wars. Minority, unquote, intelligence reports that indicated near collapse in Moscow, eluded decision makers, and, of course, the public. Occasionally, such dissent, quote, leaked, unquote, through the membranes of the concealed government, and panic resulted. Well, again, I think the growth of secrecy and the national security state, it is perhaps the most critical way that we have suffered as a nation and the most critical loss that we have experienced as a people as a result of the Cold War and as a result of the U.S. having consequently lost the Second World War. Again, not a military defeat, but a political and consequently economic defeat. I'm going to reread a section of an article that I read last week. This is from the Washington Post of April 23rd of 1992. It's an article by George Lardner Jr., who, interestingly enough, was the last person to see David Ferry alive. He interviewed David Ferry, the principal focus of Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans, the night of Ferry's, quote, suicide, unquote. And although Jim Garrison and the coroner estimated the time of death at 3 in the morning, Lardner claims that he interviewed David Ferry from midnight to 4 a.m. and said once he starts talking, it's hard to shut him up. There may perhaps have been more to that than we thought, more to that particular statement. From the Washington Post of April 23rd, we find the following with a truly Orwellian headline, CIA report on openness, classified secret. When CIA Director Robert M. Gates publicly promised, quote, a greater openness and sense of public responsibility at the intelligence agency a few weeks ago, he was acting on the recommendations of a special task force that had studied ways to make the agency more visible, credible, and responsive to the outside world. But when the 15-page, quote, task force report on greater CIA openness, unquote, was submitted to Gates December 20th, it was stamped, quote, secret, unquote, a classification formally reserved for information, quote, the unauthorized disclosure of which reasonably could be expected to cause serious damage to the national security, unquote. Skipping down in this story, the task force, headed by then CIA Public Affairs Director Joseph Detroni, capital D-E, capital T-R-A-N-I, also touted what it saw as the accomplishments of the agency's existing media program. Quote, PAO now has relationships with reporters from every major wire service, newspaper, Newsweekly, and television network in the nation, unquote, the report said. Again, quoting, this has helped us turn some, quote, intelligence failure, unquote, stories into, quote, intelligence success stories, and it has contributed to the accuracy of countless others. Quote, in many instances, the report continued, we have persuaded reporters to postpone, change, hold, or even scrap stories that could have adversely affected national security interests or jeopardized sources and methods, unquote. And note here that the Public Affairs Office of the CIA, PAO, speaking of that, the article says, actually Detroni says, PAL now has relationships with reporters from every major wire service, newspaper, Newsweekly, and television network in the nation, the report said. And that, perhaps as much as anything, illustrates the extent to which the national security state that developed during the Cold War has corrupted our democracy. One thing I'm going to do at the beginning of the program next week, and this that will actually constitute the very last item of Radio Free America 37, is to reread the section from the essay called "That," but then it was too late, that from "They Thought They Were Free." Recall that in that essay, a professor who had lived through the rise of Hitler in Germany described the process of the emergence of fascism and said what happened here was the process of the government growing more and more remote from the people as a result of national security. And we're going to reread that, or I'm going to reread that next week at the beginning of the broadcast, by way of capping off for once and for all Radio Free America 37. But again, as we see, CIA report on openness, classified secret, a truly Orwellian headline, newspeak, if ever it could be said to have existed, that I think illustrates in a very dramatic fashion the price we have paid for the development of the national security state. A very important book, which is entitled Documents, subtitled A Shocking Collection of Memoranda, Letters, and Telexes from the Secret Files of the American Intelligence Community, that was co-authored by Christy Macy, M-A-C-Y, and Susan Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N. It was published in softcover by Penguin Books, and the copyright date is 1980. Actually, it was published by Penguin Books, but the copyright is the Center for National Security Studies. And in this particular book, which, as its title indicates, is composed of documents, there is a declassified CIA memorandum from 1966, which illustrates in a very haunting fashion how the national security state has corrupted the flow of information to what is theoretically a free citizenry. This is a memorandum from 1966, again, which instructs the recipients of this memorandum on how to discredit Warren Commission critics. Now, this program, this last major installment of Radio Free America 37, is being recorded on October 18th of 1992, earlier this year, actually late last year. The Oliver Stone movie JFK came out and was met with a firestorm of criticism from media voices, great and small, including, predictably, the so-called alternative media. I think listeners should hearken back to that criticism and also to the criticism that was directed, or has been directed, at researchers into the intelligence community, with national security scandals and intelligence scandals literally oozing out all over the front pages of our daily papers from one day to the next. It is interesting to observe the firestorm of criticism of, quote, conspiracy theorists, unquote, and to evaluate that firestorm of criticism against the memorandum that I'm going to read. This particular memorandum was declassified, and it was released under the Freedom of Information Act on September of 1976, and again, it was originally distributed in 1966. And bear in mind, again, recall the castigation of Oliver Stone in his movie in the media, and the castigation of those who do research into the intelligence community in the media, including the so-called alternative media. This particular memorandum will, I think, provide a very chilling and important insight into that. The memorandum reads, "Our concern, from the day of President Kennedy's assassination on, there has been speculation about the responsibility for his murder. Although this was stemmed for a time by the Warren Commission report, which appeared at the end of September 1964, various writers have now had time to scan the Commission's published report and documents for new pretexts for questioning, and there has been a new wave of books and articles criticizing the Commission's findings. In most cases, the critics have speculated as to the existence of some kind of conspiracy, and often they have implied that the Commission itself was involved. Presumably as a result of the public opinion poll presumably as a result of the increasing challenge to the Warren Commission's report, a public opinion poll recently indicated that 46% of the American public did not think that Oswald acted alone, while more than half of those polled thought that the commission had left some questions unresolved. Doubtless, polls abroad would show similar or possibly more adverse results. In the second paragraph, this trend of opinion is a matter of concern to the U.S. government, including our organization. The members of the Warren Commission were naturally chosen for their integrity, experience, and prominence. They represented both major parties, and they and their staff were deliberately drawn from all sections of the country. Just because of the standing of the commissioners, efforts to impugn their rectitude and wisdom tend to cast doubt on the whole leadership of American society. Last sentence again. Just because of the standing of the commissioners, efforts to impugn their rectitude and wisdom tend to cast doubt on the whole leadership of American society. Moreover, there seems to be an increasing tendency to hint that President Johnson himself, as the one person who might be said to have benefited, was in some way responsible for the assassination. Innuendo of such seriousness affects not only the individual concerned, but also the whole reputation of the American government. Our organization itself is directly involved. Among other facts, we contributed information to the investigation. Conspiracy theories have frequently thrown suspicion on our organization, for example, by falsely alleging that Lee Harvey Oswald worked for us. The aim of this dispatch is to provide material for countering and discrediting the claims of the conspiracy theorists so as to inhibit the circulation of such claims in other countries. Background information is supplied in a classified section and in a number of unclassified attachments. Action. We do not recommend that discussion of the assassination question be initiated where it is not already taking place. Where discussion is active, however, addressees are requested to discuss the publicity problem with liaison and friendly elite contacts, especially politicians and editors. Again, that last sentence. Where discussion is active, however, addressees are requested to discuss the publicity problem with liaison and friendly elite contacts, especially politicians and editors, pointing out that the Warren Commission made as thorough an investigation as humanly possible, that the charges of the critics are without serious foundation, and that further speculative discussion only plays into the hands of the opposition. Point out also that parts of the conspiracy talk appear to be deliberately generated by communist propagandists. Urge them to use their influence to discourage unfounded and irresponsible speculation. To employ propaganda assets to answer and refute the attacks of the critics. Book reviews and feature articles. Now, this is B. Where discussion is active, however, addressees are requested B. To employ propaganda assets to answer and refute the attacks of the critics. Book reviews and feature articles are particularly appropriate for this purpose. And again, note that book reviews and feature articles are particularly appropriate for this purpose. The unclassified attachments to this guidance should provide useful background material for passage to assets. Our play should point out as applicable that the critics are 1. Wedded to theories adopted before the evidence was in, 2. Politically interested, 3. Financially interested, 4. Hasty and inaccurate in their research, or 5. Infatuated with their own theories. In the course of discussions of the whole phenomenon of criticism, a useful strategy may be to single out Epstein's theory for attack, using the attached Fletcher Nebel article and Spectator piece for background. Although Mark Lane's book is much less convincing than Epstein's and comes off badly where contested by knowledgeable critics, it is also much more difficult to answer as a whole, as one becomes lost in a morass of unrelated details. In private or media discussion not directed at any particular writer, or in attacking publications which may be yet forthcoming, the following arguments should be useful. A. No significant new evidence has emerged which the commission did not consider. The assassination is sometimes compared, e.g. by Joachim Yostin and Bertrand Russell, with the Dreyfus case. However, unlike that case, the attacks on the Warren Commission have produced no new evidence, no new culprits have been convincingly identified, and there is no agreement among the critics. A better parallel, though an imperfect one, might be with the Reichstag fire of 1933, which some competent historians, Fritz Tobias, A.J.P. Taylor, D.C. Watt, now believe was set by von der Lubbe on his own initiative without acting for either Nazis or communists. The Nazis tried to pin the blame on the communists, but the latter have been much more successful in convincing the world that the Nazis were to blame. This particular paragraph is chilling, and again, I think, illustrates in a dramatic fashion the price the U.S. has paid for fighting the Cold War and consequently having lost World War II. In the process, the Reichstag fire was, of course, a major provocation staged by the Nazis, the CIA's disclaimer to the contrary notwithstanding, and it was used to declare dictatorial powers, used by Hitler to declare dictatorial powers. And when we see in a declassified CIA memorandum that propaganda assets are to be instructed to compare the assassination of John F. Kennedy with the Reichstag fire, which they believe was set by a lone nut, just like Kennedy was supposedly assassinated by a lone nut. This, I think, illustrates rather chillingly not only the effects, the historical effects of the Galen Organization on the United States, the very real presence of fascism in American society long before the Galen Gang first became incorporated into our national security establishment. Recall that numerous archive shows, Radio Free America's 1 and 2, Radio Free America 10, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce. We have gone into the profound fascist sentiments and involvements of many of America's premier industrialists and financiers, and the coming of fascism to America, which it was the real underlying political reality, the political reality that underlies the Kennedy assassination. The coming of fascism to America, I think, it has never been more chillingly illustrated than by this paragraph of this memorandum, which again instructs CIA propaganda assets to refute Warren Commission critics by comparing the Kennedy assassination to the Reichstag fire, the work of a lone nut. Recall that in Radio Free America number 2 and a section of that program that was reprised on September 13th of this year as part of Radio Free America 37, in April of 1981, the Reichstag fire was made unchallengeable. The Reichstag fire verdict, I should say, was made unchallengeable German law as a result of a decision by the German Supreme Court. In another installment of Radio Free America 37, we looked at the reinstatement of the Third Reich's judiciary. And again, this particular paragraph is indeed chilling, where it says, "The Nazis tried to pin the blame on the communists, but the latter have been much more successful in convincing the world that the Nazis were to blame." So, as I like to say, read 'em and weep, baby. Read 'em and weep. Next paragraph. "Critics usually overvalue particular items and ignore others. They tend to place more emphasis on the recollections of individual eyewitnesses, which are less reliable and more divergent, and hence offer more handholds for criticism, and less on ballistic autopsy and photographic evidence. A close examination of the Commission's records will usually show that the conflicting eyewitness accounts are quoted out of context or were discarded by the Commission for good and sufficient reason. Conspiracy on the large scale often suggested," now this is the next paragraph, "conspiracy on the large scale often suggested would be impossible to conceal in the United States, especially since informants could expect to receive large royalties, etc. Note that Robert Kennedy, Attorney General at the time, and John F. Kennedy's brother, would be the last man to overlook or conceal any conspiracy. As one reviewer pointed out, Congressman Gerald R. Ford would hardly have held his tongue for the sake of the Democratic administration, and Senator Russell would have had every political interest in exposing any misdeeds on the part of Chief Justice Warren. A conspirator, moreover, would hardly choose a location for a shooting where so much depended on conditions beyond his control. The route, the speed of the cars, the moving target, the risk that the assassin would be discovered. A group of wealthy conspirators could have arranged much more secure conditions." The next paragraph. "Critics have often been enticed by a form of intellectual pride. They light on some theory and fall in love with it. They also scoff at the commission because it did not always answer every question with a flat decision one way or the other. Actually, the makeup of the commission and its staff was an excellent safeguard against overcommitment to any one theory or against the illicit transformation of probabilities into certainties. Well, if the phrase begging the question ever applied to anything, it applies to this here. I think it pretty much speaks for itself. And again, I'm not going to go into the Kennedy assassination during the course of the present discussion. There are many, many archive shows, including a long sections of Radio Free America number 37 that do that. I refer listeners to the Guns of November series done in November of 1983 on the 20th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. Also, Radio Free America shows 10 through 13 and program number 15 as well. And again, long sections of RFA 37 deal with the Kennedy assassination. The official version isn't just wrong, it's absolutely ludicrous. All of the Warren Commission's major theories, all of the major aspects of the Warren Commission's thesis are completely wrong, and most of them physically impossible. But again, the instructions being given here to CIA propaganda assets are a classic form of begging the question, and one need only refer back to the firestorm of criticism directed at Oliver Stone to see the direct employment of many of these same instructions. A number of them pointed out that specifically the very first instruction in this last paragraph, conspiracy on the large scale often suggested would be impossible to conceal in the United States. Well, that's true enough. It hasn't been concealed. Unfortunately, it has been buried by other items. People haven't paid attention, and dispatches like this on the part of the National Security Establishment have played a significant role in that. Moving on. The next line of argument to be used to refute the Commission's critics, in paragraph E, Oswald would not have been any sensible person's choice for a co-conspirator. He was a, quote, loner, unquote, mixed up, of questionable reliability, and an unknown quantity to any professional intelligence service. Skipping down a paragraph, such vague accusations as that, quote, more than 10 people have died mysteriously, unquote, can always be explained in some more natural way, e.g. the individuals concerned have for the most part died of natural causes. The commission staff co-questioned 418 witnesses. The FBI interviewed far more people, conducting 25,000 interviews and re-interviews. And in such a large group, a certain number of deaths are to be expected. When Penn Jones, one of the originators of the, quote, 10 mysterious deaths, unquote, line, appeared on television, it emerged that two of the deaths on his list were from heart attacks, one from cancer, one was from a head-on collision on a bridge, and one occurred when a driver drifted into a bridge abutment. Well, one of the things that we've looked at in another declassified document from this very book, Documents, is that the intelligence community had developed ways of killing people in such a way as to make it appear to be natural causes or suicide. So this this paragraph also is a classic example of begging the question. Last paragraph, where possible, counter-speculation by encouraging reference to the commission's report itself. Open-minded foreign readers should still be impressed by the care, thoroughness, objectivity, and speed with which the Warren Commission worked. Reviewers of other books might be encouraged to add to their account the idea that, checking back with the report itself, they found it far superior to the work of its critics. And again, refer back to the firestorm that was directed at Oliver Stone's JFK. You will see the direct employment of many of the suggestions that the CIA was directing towards its so-called propaganda assets. You will see many of those suggestions incorporated directly into the criticisms of the Oliver Stone film. The growth of the national security state has resulted in a great many abuses, and the media, unfortunately, have served to cover those up. Reflecting briefly on the memorandum that we just read, and again, that's a declassified CIA memorandum from 1966, let's jump ahead to the Los Angeles Times of September 22nd of 1992. This is an article by Steve Weinstein of the LA Times. Its headline, quote, quantum, unquote, leaps into the JFK assassination. Subtitled Television. On the season premiere tonight, Sam jumps into a script supporting the lone gunman theory. The article reads in part as follows. By the way, the executive producer of this program, which endorses the lone nut theory, the single gunman theory, is a guy named Donald P. Belisario, last name spelled B-E-L-L-I-S-A-R-I-O, and in recounting what motivated him to produce this particular program, Belisario was quoted as follows. But I guess what really struck me the strongest was when my 12-year-old son went to see Oliver Stone's JFK and came home totally brainwashed by the film and started telling me all of these half-truths, falsehoods, and speculation as if they were fact. And I decided if I could figure out a way to bring the tale closer to the truth, no one knows the truth, and no one will probably ever know it precisely, put forth another argument, another theory, another side to the story that would be a good thing to do, unquote. And one of the things that Belisario decided would be a good thing to do would be to demonstrate that the Warren Commission's investigation had been a good one, and in order to established verisimilitude, he decided to use an authentic Mannlicher-Carcano rifle. And the results of using an authentic Mannlicher-Carcano rifle were as follows. Returning to the article. On the Quantum Leap soundstage earlier this summer, an actor posing as Lee Harvey Oswald points an authentic Mannlicher-Carcano rifle, just like the one that the Warren Commission concluded Oswald used to kill Kennedy, out a fake movie set window. Peering through the scope, he pulls the trigger and a loud shot echoes through the cavernous building. The actor cranks the rifle to eject a spent cartridge and chamber another, but the mechanism jams. Quote, "Well, we just proved Oswald couldn't have done it," unquote, a member of the crew quips. Moving on into the article, in the inside page, on take two, the gun jams again. Take three, same story. Quote, "Kennedy lives," unquote, cries another crew member. On take four, the actor again struggles with the crank. For take five, he rapidly fires two shots but can't get out the third. The company takes a break so that experts can fiddle with the gun. Eventually, three shots ring out without a hitch. And even though Oswald only had one take, those shots on film provide proof, Belisario contends, that if an actor who never fired a gun before could manipulate the old rifle, then Oswald, whom Belisario portrays as an expert marksman, could easily have succeeded in killing Kennedy. Well, this is yet another of the official lies concerning the Kennedy assassination. Oswald was a lousy shot. He was a Marine Corps sharpshooter, which has thrown people off. That's the lowest category of marksmanship in the Marine Corps, which places a premium on marksmanship, that dating back to the age of sail when Marines were stationed in the rigging of ships and were assigned to pick off sailors on the decks of other ships. That required excellent marksmanship to fire accurately from the rigging of a ship that was pitching in the waves. But the lowest category of marksmanship in the Marine Corps, the lowest you can achieve in order to still stay in, is sharpshooter, and that's what Oswald was. He was a lousy shot, besides which the rifle that he supposedly used to kill Kennedy was sighted in for a left-handed shooter, and Oswald was right-handed. He wouldn't have been able to hit anything with a scope that far out of adjustment. Interestingly enough, as we skip down into this particular article, we find out an interesting bit of biographical information concerning Donald Belisario. Of him, the article says, he, meaning Belisario, even speaks of first-hand knowledge of Oswald, a chance Marine Corps meeting in 1959 that Belisario includes in his script. Belisario and Oswald both served in Marine Air Control squadrons, and they were stationed at different times at a base in Tustin. After completing his service, Belisario went back to Tustin one day in early 1959 to visit some of his old buddies. There, he recalled, he began arguing with a Marine sitting on the floor in a supply shed who was reading some revolutionary newspaper. Quote, "Here's this Marine telling me something that I would expect to hear coming out of Radio Moscow, a whole lot of communist doctrine," unquote, Belisario said. Again quoting, "I got incensed, and if you brought up something he didn't like, he just kind of sneered at you. Finally, I just walked away, and I asked another Marine there, quote, 'What the hell is with this jerk?' unquote. And he said, 'Oh, he does that to everyone. He's harmless,'" unquote. Well, one has to wonder. Here we find Donald Belisario endorsing the utterly preposterous Warren Commission thesis, and as it turns out, he had a, quote, chance, unquote, encounter with Oswald when Oswald was getting his Marxist cover before he, quote, defected, unquote, to the Soviet Union. Perhaps it was a chance occurrence, but there are an awful lot of chance events with the Kennedy assassination, and one of the possibilities that I think needs to be entertained is that possibly Donald Belisario is another of these propaganda assets, and that perhaps, obviously this is speculative, that chance meeting wasn't a chance meeting at all, but may have been accomplished in order to establish Lee Harvey Oswald's bona fides as a, quote, marksman, unquote. The Kennedy assassination certainly was not the first national security scandal to overtake the United States. It remains arguably the most important, but there have been an awful lot of them since, not just the other political assassinations this country has experienced, but a plethora of national security scandals that continues to dog us or to plague us to this day. And indeed, in order to evaluate the effects of the growth of the national security state on the United States, just pick up a daily paper and take a look at the headlines. And again, this program is being recorded on Sunday, October 18th of 1992, and the national security scandals and the cover-ups, the effects on American society so eloquently described by Saul Landau in the column that I began tonight's broadcast with. Well, just pick up a newspaper and take a look. As I've said before on this in this series, read 'em and weep, baby. Read 'em and weep. The San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, October 15th of 1992, has an article by John Aloysius Farrell of the Boston Globe, dateline Atlanta, headlined, Scandal Dogs Bush Administration.